You are listening to a sermon by Ken Friesen, recorded on Sunday, September 18th, 2016, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for having me here today. It's a place, obviously, I feel very much at home at, more so than anywhere else in this church world. You know, this is a big weekend for MCC. Most people are familiar with it. It's Mennonite Central Committee. I have been on the board for 15 years, but I'm just off the board. I rewrote the Constitution, and the maximum you can be on is 8 years, and so my time came to an end. As indicated, I was in Lebanon this past spring, about May of this year, and it was an MCC learning tour. And a couple of years ago, I went on an MCC learning tour to Israel and Palestine. So this is the second learning tour I went on. Most of the individuals going on these tours are ministers in Mennonite churches, people that are associated in some way with MCC. And on this tour, we had a number of people that work with refugees from their MCC workers with refugees. And we had a number of individuals that now I work with in terms of Legacy Trust, such as the executive director who we just hired this last January.
Right next door is Israel and Palestine, where I went before, and that's just happenstance. Currently, obviously, in Syria, we have an enormous number of refugees. MCC historically had offices in most of the Middle Eastern countries, and have been in the Middle Eastern countries for a long time. They have, for instance, been in the Palestine area working since 1949, and if one remembers, it's 1948 is when the Israel-Arab War took place. So we've been in this area a long time. And in Lebanon, primarily, our role has been to work with Palestinian refugees. And so it is out of that background of work that we now find ourselves working with Syrian refugees. And so that's the kind of reason that that Lebanon was chosen as the tour at this time, just because of the enormous work that's required. So as my mother indicated, and there's questions about my shift on it, my focus on MCC has shifted from being on the board and dealing with issues related to the many issues that a charity faces, to really one avenue, and that is on development of funding for MCC over a long term. And as I indicated before, we thought about it on the board level about how we fund MCC and how estates would work in the context of MCC. My background, of course, is in estates and as a lawyer. And so it's been a kind of a focus of myself and as background as well. And my family background is also involved in real estate. So those two areas have kind of come together for me working with MCC. A couple of years ago, we were approached to receive assets, first in Prince George, then Parksville, and then in Chilliwack. In Chilliwack, we have a development that's probably going to take 20 to 30 years as we develop single-family and multifamily residences. And we have a development in Parksville that's about 300 lots. That's in midstream of development. And we have in Prince George a 250-unit apartment building, which is really on the kind of degraded level of condition currently. These are assets, many of them, that the donator couldn't really handle at that time. And it just so happens that in the meantime, his wife has passed away, who did much of the management, the day-to-day management, while he was the dreamer. In the meantime, just in this last week, his health has deteriorated a great deal and is now in need of 24-hour care. So this is kind of a work in transition as we receive assets and How do we manage them? Well, we engage members of the Mennonite greater community. For instance, in Parksville, we've engaged Peter Redekop for $1 a year to manage and develop the real estate in Parksville. So it's relying on our community supports. And it is a particular time in history of the Mennonites. We come here to British Columbia, and many Mennonites in particular have involved themselves in the real estate business. And as we all know, the real estate business has been a good one for a number of years. And so these same Mennonites often have come over from Ukraine, from Europe and elsewhere, and have done so with the help of organizations such as MCC, and feel a lot of connection to MCC. That connection may be beginning to be lost with this latest generation, but it is an affiliation that is very strong amongst obviously people that were directly affected in terms of coming over to Canada. So a lot of people have generated an enormous amount of wealth in the context of their life's work of real estate in British Columbia that are affiliated with MCC and want to find mission in the context of their work as their life's work comes to an end. They have a portfolio of assets, and they want to know and want to feel that they've done right by their lives. And this is coincident with the time, I think, where statistically the number of givers in Canada, those that donate to charity, has diminished a great deal. And it diminishes if one looks statistically year by year. And so if one was to look at Revenue Canada figures, the number of people that donate year by year keeps decreasing marginally every year. The amount that's donated to charities has gone up because those that do donate have given more. But and this is one of the board concerns, we have prospectively a coming together of concerns, people that are maybe unattached to Mennonite Central Committee, Mennonite churches that are specifically unattached to MCC, and perhaps a detachment on the greater scale by individuals to charitable giving. And if those all come together and keep going, you have a sort of a reckoning, a financial reckoning that occurs within the context of the charity industry, or more particularly MCC. And one of the ways we see addressing this is to, at this time and place, that is British Columbia and here now, is to work with those that are have large estate portfolios, real estate portfolios, and there are a number of tax and personal reasons and business reasons why donating a portfolio of assets, real estate assets, is better than winding up one's estate upon one's death and just donating the money generally. It is to see that one's life's real estate work can become be turned into charitable giving. And as I indicated earlier, this couple that has donated specifically, and I wrote up the trust agreements, where their ideas vis-a-vis these funds is that they want them to be given in perpetuity, virtually perpetuity, that's a legal term which I avoided, but just to understand it, they want it to be given so that these funds keep giving, keep being made to help the poorest and the poor. And I think, by and large, our community, that's the kind of things that people would like to see with their assets. And so in the context of now my work on moving from MCC BC board work to chair of the MCC Legacy Trust is to develop these ideas about giving, to put in place the right individuals that are in context of development and the context of apartment management and commercial and various other kinds of development. And to set up the right systems so that we can support the wishes of people that have donated assets and to further the interests of MCC. And just technically, we're like a foundation. We're not a foundation because we're just companies owned, shares owned by MCC in companies that are real in the real estate business. So we're not a charity per se, but we're wholly owned by MCC, the charity. Just to understand the difference. It's best to understand it in the context of foundation, because that's how people understand these things. But the ideas of foundations, even though they're still ongoing, they've changed the tax rules and they're not important anymore. So that's why we're not a foundation per se. So that's where I've been up to in the last couple of years with MCC. And it is in that context then that I took our recent hires to Lebanon. And I say I took. I went with them, and it was led, the tour was led by individuals that had been here before on behalf of MCC that take people on those tours. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Lebanon. Lebanon is a country of about 4.3 million people. And it just sits right above Israel and Palestine. It's fairly mountainous. If you've been to Santa Barbara, it looks very similar. You're right there on the water, and then you look up, and there's mountains all above you. And then you cross over the mountains, and then you're into a wine-growing region. So that's what it looks like. There are, as I say, about 4.5 million, 4.3 million people. There are 1.1 million Syrian refugees currently in Lebanon. And there are, from the period 1948, some 450,000 registered Palestinians, registered with the UN, that have been there, either been there since 19, I've been in Lebanon since 1948, or they obviously were born in Lebanon, but are Palestinians. So you have about 1.5 million refugees in a country of about 4.3 million people. And that has caused enormous troubles in Lebanon. And this is a country that's just come off a 15-year war that ended in 1990. So it was kind of regarded as the Paris, or Beirut was regarded as the Paris of the Middle East, and there's a lot of history as you walk through the town which would indicate that was the case. But it's no longer the case. It was the banking center and so on, but it has none of that. It has a history of troubles, and they are finding it very difficult to be neighbors to the people that have come in. They're just overwhelmed. And in a way, I hear the same thing. We were recently speaking with friends of ours from Germany. They're finding it difficult to be neighbors to, and they're in a country of some 60 million. Right? So, Lebanon is a unique country. It's a purely sectarian country. And sectarian, of course, is sex and different groups. And there are 18 religious groups that are recognized in Lebanon. And they've been recognized since 1932 when this system was kind of set up. And it's a recognition of everybody in the context of their particular sect. And that is to say, if you're a Sunni Muslim, if you're a Druze, if you're a Maronite Christian, if you're Orthodox Christian, you're in that group. And the political structure is based only on sectarian affiliation. There was a census in 1932, which set out a percentage of individuals by different groups. At that time, the Maronite Christians were the largest group, and Christians were the largest group in Lebanon. Since that time, it has decreased. But as a result of that system, the president, by definition, is a Maronite Christian. The prime minister is a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of the parliament is a Shia Muslim. And that's just the way it is, and it will not change. There's not been a census since 1932, and there's no appetite to do a new census because there's too much fear that they will lose their institutionalized system. So, and as I say, there's 18 groups that are recognized. And so in Parliament, you'll have by percentages that were established in 1932 that have been amended somewhat. They have set out the number of seats that you could hold according to your sect. Now, as I indicated, primarily MCC's work within Lebanon has been with the refugees. And we visited a refugee camp. We visited a number of refugee camps during our trip. They do not appear as camps as we understand them. They're certainly Syrian refugee camps that look like camps as we understand them, with tents and the like. But these Palestinian camps are just very, very dense, overcrowded areas that have been settled some 70 years ago, set up by the UN initially. They just appear poorer and more overcrowded than the other areas of the city. The Palestinians, despite having lived in Lebanon for some 70 years, or have been born in Lebanon, most likely, are considered foreigners. They are restricted from most schooling. They are restricted from owning property. They are restricted from any types of employment that are beyond the most basic, rudimentary kind of skill level employment. For a variety of reasons, it serves a number of interests in that the Palestinians remain untethered, at least untethered to Lebanon. Until the recent arrival of Syrians in Lebanon, the Palestinians were always the poorest of the poor. Now, typically, MCC provides support and resources to local aid organizations, and they sometimes are act as startups for aid, local aid organizations, and this is the case in Lebanon. Housing is a big problem. You have 1.5 million people that come from outside. Rents are extremely high. There are also tent cities. We visited some of those, various locations. Some of them are right, beautiful locations right on the Mediterranean, except they get inundated by water at high tide. Some are designated, some are makeshift. MCC tends to be involved in primary schooling, peace and reconciliation work, war and trauma, healing, and what they call psychosocial, which seems to be a common term there, and obviously dealing with a lot of war trauma, and a lot of problems in families. Families that are split apart, and families where people can't find work, provide for their family, and the like, it obviously leads to what we'll, I guess, describe as psychosocial problems. And we bring in a lot of material aid. And this is through Lebanon to Syria as well. We, MCC, Mennonites, are not part of the 18 recognized religious groups. And so when we bring in material aid into Lebanon, it's taxed, and taxed very highly, you have import tax. To get around the import tax, we have to affiliate. And for instance, with the Syrian Orthodox Church, who we were able to meet the patriarch and the like, they then receive the material aid offshore, and then they bring it through, and then they bring it to, they take a third, and then they take it through. These are the deals you have to make. So, as I indicated, there were a number of individuals that come out of BC, some with Legacy Trust. We had a number of refugee workers, one from Ontario, one from British Columbia, and they went on to a state after the tour to do some setup work for refugee, with respect to refugees. Most Syrians wish to return home. Some feel that they cannot. Some of them are on the, obviously made it through to Europe, and some are making it to Canada. And so some people, there's some, but we're talking about Syria, half the country's been displaced. So I wasn't aware, and I see now that someone has covered the same text as I did from last week. So you're going to hear it from a different perspective, not a theologian, but a lawyer. And so what was read at Luke 25 to 37 is the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I'm now going to turn to that section. I am not aware of what was spoken last week on that subject. I may be repeating some, but here we go. Verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? He replied, how do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you will live. But he, the lawyer, wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? And in reply, Jesus said, a man was going down to Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for an extra expense you may have. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robber? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. Now, in the time before journalism, it seemed that in Jewish society, lawyers were left with the presumptive duty to ask the hard questions. It is conceived that lawyers generally don't come off looking very good in the Bible. By contrast, judges come off looking very good. Kings, not so good. It is a lawyer who introduces the topic of who is my neighbor. So how do we jump from inheriting eternal life to the question of who is my neighbor? The first question posed by this lawyer is really one of those stock questions, and Jesus throws back at him, and the lawyer provides a stock Sunday school answer, quoting from Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your strength and all your mind. That obviously deals with the theological end. On the practical end, and love your neighbor as yourself. It is, of course, the right answer, but the lawyer had provided the answer, and it was not Jesus that did so. So, the lawyer then goes on, and it's from a subjective standpoint, he goes on to want to justify himself. It's a little hard to figure out what exactly is going on in the lawyer's head when he says he wants to justify himself. I don't know what the reasoning is. Perhaps it's because the first answer was self-evident from a read of the Old Testament. Or, in the sense that the lawyer felt that he could justify his life based on being able to live up to that term if he could have a narrow definition of the question of who his neighbor was. Now, the term neighbor, in a more limited understanding of that, seemed to be the more prevalent understanding. I say prevalent because if this was a consensus on the point of who my neighbor is, then one would have to say the question would not be asked. In other words, if the lawyer is asking a question of who my neighbor is, there must have been a tinge of understanding that maybe a neighbor is not just these people right next to you in the same sect, religion, or group. I'm going to turn now to Matthew 5, 43-48, which reads as follows. You have heard that it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, and that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, may be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And Leviticus 19:18, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbors as yourself. I am the Lord. Let me read that again. You shall not bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbors as yourself. I am the Lord. I read those verses because, at least on the definition question, they seem to limit a neighbor to a closely related person by race, religion, and not simply location. It may be that this lawyer reasonably felt, following the law as he understood it, that he followed the commandments that were required in the law, and that his life could reasonably be justified because he was living up to the terms of the law. So for the purpose of this review, which I'm undertaking, let's assume the lawyer is right. That neighbor, at least into that section, as he stated it, the lawyer stated it to Jesus, and Jesus says, you are right. Let's say it's the more limited understanding of the term neighbor. That a neighbor, by definition under the law, is someone in the same tribe. The MCC was founded in the 1920s. It was founded by Mennonites responding to Mennonite concerns in the Ukraine. And we got to the point where we're feeding up to 40 to 60,000 people a day in the Ukraine. After the Ukraine crisis had ended, MCC kind of proceeded for about 10 years before it began work in Syria, in serious work in the, during or after the World War II in the 40s, in helping people settle and dealing with the aftermath of the war. But certainly, the creation of MCC was Mennonites helping Mennonites at the root. So, from the tribal perspective, helping the neighbor, MCC started with helping one's neighbor as we understood it. The Maronite president of Lebanon, by definition, he's to look after the interests of the Maronite community in Lebanon. It's a sectarian state, and every group was to look after their own, by definition. It would seem, to a large extent, that looking after one's own tribe is inbred, perhaps even codified in the law. There remains, however, something kind of unsettling about this, limiting oneself to looking after one's own. But it seems to be a prevailing opinion. It is the de facto way in which most of the world lives. Certainly a more expansive definition of neighbor is awfully hard to live by, because in many respects it's limitless. There is a disconnect that occurs in this literal interpretation of the law about neighbor, as is seen in the parable that follows. That is, there is not a straight line, as perhaps could be presumed, from the Sunday school answer of strict adherence to the law to inheriting eternal life. At the root of this difference is the propensity to look at the law to prescribe behavior. Whether it is absolute compliance with the law in Leviticus or zealous regard for propriety. Lessons learned in the parables are not in the nature of prescriptions of behavior, thou shalt or thou shalt not, but descriptions of behavior, go and do likewise. Looking at the priests in the parable, we all probably have a general understanding that there are prohibitions on priests placing themselves in positions where they become unclean. And to become unclean disqualifies a priest or a Levite from active duty in the temple. Clearly, a priest first and foremost has a duty to follow the law and to fulfill their duties. In this section, it should be noted that the priest and the Levite following the law could find some justification under the law for not defiling themselves and not helping the man on the side of the road. In my reading of this section, there is commentary that the law allowed for an exception to the prohibition of touching corpses, allowing for the touching of, quote, neglected corpses. However, in this passage, both the priest and Levite had not gotten to the stage of knowing whether the person on the side of the road was in fact a corpse. Thus, they avoided finding out by passing on the other side of the road. Ultimately, the idea of potentially being defiled, which would exclude them from service in the temple for a period of time, was of more import than determining if this man was alive and in need of care. It is never stated in this section who this person was on the side of the road is. In other words, he is a man of the road. He is kind of a blank slate. We don't know if he's a Jew or if he came from afar or if he came locally. He could be, and most likely, statistically, he would be a Jew. He could be one of their own. But this potential corpse or person in need is not a known. He's not a neighbor in that sense. His identity or affiliation is simply not mentioned. The depiction of travel downward from Jerusalem to Jericho on this road indicates that likely for the Levite and for the priest, their duties have been already completed and they were heading back. So there is some understanding that perhaps they could have done more and been perhaps not offside the law. But I think the understanding is generally in the section that they put themselves offside the law, put themselves outside their priestly duties, potentially. Further reference materials which I reviewed suggest that Jesus' target audience in terms of this parable, the Jews, that they hated Samaritans to such a degree that the lawyer's phrase, "the one who had mercy on him," may in fact indicate a reluctance to name the Samaritan. And one of the most, in terms of my trip to Lebanon, one of the more interesting aspects that really took me for a moment was we would often spend our time, because our work historically has been with the Palestinians. And again, we're Palestinians, and we sit right above Israel and the West Bank. And as we traveled south in Lebanon down towards the border, Israel is not mentioned by name. You just can't say it. You can't say it out loud. It's not written in the maps of the region. And so you're left with this strange notion that you have the country to our south. But you can't usually say Israel. So the idea, descriptor of them saying the one who had mercy on him, is a recognition there's a person there, but we can't actually name that person. The Samaritans in turn hated the Jews. It was said during this time period that the tensions between the Samaritans and the Jews were particularly high because there was a desecration by the Samaritans of the Holy Temple at Passover. And by way of background, I looked up the Samaritans because it's always been in our head that who Samaritans are, obviously an offshoot of, they wouldn't call themselves an offshoot. They are a derivation of, going back, they are the same groupings of as the Jews, but they had different views about where the capital of Jerusalem should be. And they believed it's in Mount Gerizim, and while the Jews believe it should be Jerusalem. And so it caused a split in the group at that time. And even though they obviously had closeness, they were certainly not a neighbor, as they understood it at that time. They're the same ethnically, and virtually the same religiously, as we would understand it. And just by way of background, one of the difficulties, there's now 777 supposedly Samaritans in the world, located in Israel and Palestine, but they have a very hard time bringing people in because they have in fact a stricter interpretation of Leviticus and the law than even Orthodox Jews. So it makes it difficult for them to hold individuals in their group. But It's somewhat ironic given the response of course, the Good Samaritan in that context. It is very similar in the sense that for 400 years prior to the First World War, Lebanon and Syria were the same country. And part of what was known as Greater Syria is groups that, for our eyes, eat the same food, speak the same language, have the same sort of ethnic mix, same sort of sectarian divisions. The percentages may be different, but for all intents and purposes, it is really the same group, ethnically and otherwise, the Lebanese and Syrians. But certainly, the Syrians are subject to the same restrictions that the Palestinians are subject to or have been subject to for the last 70 years, which is they cannot take on gainful employment of any note. They're not entitled to own land, not entitled to the schooling and the like. So the needs are quite remarkable. There is a common reading of this parable that argues that everyone is to be treated as a neighbor without distinction. However, the scope of neighborly concern and that the scope of neighborly concern should embrace everyone within it. I would, however, posit that the term neighbor is never quite that generic in this section, and isn't polygeneric in how we treat life. And it's kind of dangerous to make assumptions about how people act that are utterly at odds with how interpretation, even well-meaning interpretation of the Bible. People do stick to their tribe. Mennonites have to be an example of that. But that's not the end of the section, and the parable Jesus describes how we ultimately have to regard the other and act in their context. Let me go on. The Samaritan pours on oil and wine. Does this help? As it turns out, wine was the disinfectant of the day and oil used to coat the wound. The Samaritan is practical and got things done. He applied medical care, he took a half-dead a man on his donkey and brought him to an inn. He didn't just dump him there, but in a practical way, did not make the innkeeper take on this charity. He gave the innkeeper money and he said that, look, if there's more, I'll reimburse you when I come back. That seems very practical. Now Jesus turns back to the question of who or who not, who is not my neighbor, as posed at paragraph 29. And at verse 27, love your neighbor as yourself. So Jesus turns the question of who is my neighbor, and instead asks the question at paragraph 36 of which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man? Not who the neighbor was, but who was a neighbor. In the parable and in this ultimate question, Jesus is showing us that characteristics of a neighbor, not as a class of peoples defined by DNA, religion, or culture, but by personal characteristics that are entirely unrelated to the definition question posed by the lawyer at paragraph 29 of who is my neighbor? The lawyer questioning Jesus probably expects an answer to the question of the identity of his neighbor that clearly delineates one group from the other. However, Jesus' answer does not present us with a static set of neighbors and not neighbors. Rather, he offers a picture of a dynamic process of the formation of neighborly bonds. And these neighborly bonds, in the case of the Good Samaritan, in the case of MCC, are maintained through the expression of mercy. This is not the end of the chapter, Luke chapter 10. That's the end of the parable of the Samaritan. But there are a few verses thereafter. And these verses may leave a few people puzzled, particularly if they're read on their own without reference. So they're part of chapter 10, and they flow directly from the story of the parable. But on their own, they're difficult to read. So I thought I would explore them as well. And so it's the story of Mary and Martha, which immediately follows the parable. And it explores some of the same themes. So I'm going to read it to you now. This is paragraphs 38 through 41. And this is at the home of Mary and Martha. And Jesus and his disciples were on their way. He came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had been made. She came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen the good portion, and it will not be taken away from her." Now, it's easy to see the sort of double bind that is often placed on women, the expectation to serve accompanied by the judgment that they have been more like Mary. This, however, is not really the point. This section needs to be read alongside the Good Samaritan parable that just precedes it. Both are shaped by the theme of inheritance. The lawyer wants to know what to do to inherit. For Mary, we are informed that she has chosen the good portion. And from other readings in Psalm, the good portion is equated to inheritance. In Psalm 16:5-6, the reference to good portion is made. "Lord, you are alone. You alone are my portion or my cup, and make my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance." So Mary has chosen her inheritance. So like the priest or like the Levite, Martha is preoccupied with offering the bread of God. As such, represents those who seek their inheritance through rigid observance. And the Samaritans appreciate that compassion is more important than rigid observance. And for Mary, the one who dwells in the temple is greater than the service of that temple. So these are complicated thoughts. But if one was to read, and I don't have to spend a lot of time on this section, but if one is to read that section alone, I think it's virtually impossible of Martha and Mary to understand it without looking back at the idea of the temple, service of the temple, rather than service of the one who's in the temple. And that correlates to what the Samaritan did, as opposed to the priests and Levites or the service of the temple, while the Samaritan was in service of the one who's in the temple. And that's how it correlates directly with Martha and Mary. Now, in terms of neighbors, Europe neighbors the Middle East. They consequently have been called upon to be neighborly to the many refugees that have been down the road, their road or over the sea to them. No doubt they're being called to be neighbors because of their location. Now, I introduced this topic talking about MCC Legacy Trust. And I said there's something unique about this place, British Columbia, and this time and place. 2016 and where we are in terms of people that are affiliated with MCC, their retirement, people developing real estate assets, and generally the wealth now within the Mennonite community is unparalleled. And there's a once in a many generation chance to use the resources in the Mennonite community to do what Jesus commanded us to do. The Samaritan had an opportunity presented and a capacity to make the difference. Of that, Jesus said, "Go and do likewise." Given our capacity and the needs outstanding, and I would say our reach throughout the world, and MCC now has been in this area of the world since the 40s, I think the bar is raised pretty high for us, therefore, to go and do likewise.